This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon. Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here for yet another event in our Cornell Writers on Cornell Writers series. Can everybody hear? I'll test this out for other people. Okay. Well, Bob is going first. Bob, I don't know if you even knew that, Bob, but you are. Okay. All right. So as I tried to summarize Bob Morgan's awards and prizes and books, I finally thought it best to say something simple and to the point. And I wrote, Bob's honors make me dizzy. That's really how I was feeling. We all know him as a modest and brilliant presence and someone able to write just about anything, to be a great poet, a novelist, critic, and most recently, biographer. He was born, as some of you know, in Henderson, North Carolina, and grew up in the Green River Valley of the Blue Ridge Mountains. He studied engineering and applied mathematics at North Carolina State before transferring to Chapel Hill, where he received his BA in English. He then earned a master's degree at University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Bob's most recent vertigo-inducing honors include the 2007 Academy Award, I love that, in literature. There ought to be, why not? From the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the James B. Haynes Poetry Prize, and the North Carolina Literature Award. He's also received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, 3 grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. He's published 11 books of superb, absolutely first-rate poetry. And when I was writing this, I was thinking, well, large bodies of work. Usually the adjective uneven comes up, but in this case I can truly say these books are even sounds terrible, so let's just say superb. They're all absolutely wonderful, including The Strange Attractor, New and Selected Poems. He's also written a book of essays on poetry, Good Measure, 3 books of short fiction, and 5 novels, Gap Creek, a novel of exquisite characterizations and enviable narrative momentum, was a New York Times bestseller. It received the Southern Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, the Appalachian Writers Association Book of the Year Award, and was a selection of the Oprah Book Club. And Bob's most recent book, Boone, a biography, received the 2008 Thomas Wolfe Prize, the Kennedy Literary Award for Nonfiction, and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Award. So Bob has been teaching here since 1971, goodness, and I've been standing in awe of his energies and gifts since 1980, yes, when I met him. Today he's going to be speaking on Baxter Hathaway, who founded both Cornell's Creative Writing Program and Epic Magazine. Bob has a formidable memory, and he's an enthralling storyteller, so this is sure to be fun. Bob.
Thank you, Alice. I really appreciate that. But actually, I'll be talking about James McConkie, and not... who knew Baxter Hathaway quite well? In some ways, not in others. This got out of hand. It got too long. I tried to carve it down to maybe 20 minutes. And we'll see if I can read passages from McConkie without weeping. He tends to make me weep sometimes. I'll begin with a quote from Walden. Moreover, I, on my side, require of every writer, first or last, a simple and sincere account of his own life. When I came to Cornell in 1971, I already knew the work of some of my colleagues. I was familiar with the Norton Anthology of English Literature, edited by M.H. Abrams, the poems of A.R. Ammons, Robert H. Elias's study of Theodore Dreiser, Apostle of Nature, and Walter Slatoff's With Respect to Readers. and Baxter Hathaway and Epoch Magazine. The great surprise to me was the writing of James McConkie. I've been told that McConkie was a fiction writer, but early on in my reading of the book called Crossroads, I came on this passage. One night, more than 7 years ago, as I sat in my darkened basement study, I became conscious to a heightened degree of the details of my surroundings and life. A piece of fiction I had just written was contrived and thin, measured against the site of a long vacated bird's nest mounded with snow in the backyard maple and faintly illuminated by starlight, or against the feel of a dog's cold and moist nose on my skin. My relationship with my family and children was suddenly of such consequence to me that I wondered how any of my days had ever seemed routine or commonplace. For I thought the world, at least as I had known it, was likely to end fairly soon. I needed that night to impose order upon my own experience and to communicate what I felt to anybody who would listen. And so I began the first of a series of accounts that make up this autobiographical novel. Later in the book called Court of Memory, McConkie would again describe this profound turning point in his life. The story I had written was unsatisfactory because it was made up, a fiction, one devoid of the sacredness I saw everywhere around me. The only way open to me to communicate the strength of my feelings was through myself, through my intimate experiences, through memory and personal observation. At that moment in my own life, I began an autobiographical account of the meaning implicit in one of the humblest objects imaginable, a botched up nightstand I had built as a child for my mother. I forgot to tell you the title of this. It's James McConkie and the Quest for the Sacred. I discovered that McConkie's first book of stories was called Nightstand. And the memory of that little table was the trigger for the abundance of memory that followed. McConkie explained that he decided to give up writing about imagined characters and write only about his own experience because he was disturbed by the events and threats of the early 1960s, such as the Cuban Missile Crisis, by, quote, a sense of desperation at the folly of public affairs, by a sense of human irrationality demonstrated in present history and the history of the recent past, including the evil of Auschwitz. One either went inward, striving to testify to the meaning that still existed for the individual, or one went outward beyond the personal truth to the region in which the sacred apparently no longer existed, the outer world in which the individual had lost his uniqueness, that world which lacked apparent logic or causality or even substance. As I read McConkie's stories about himself and his family and his memories, I discovered his ongoing fascination with the confessions of St. Augustine. This surprised me at first because McConkie was so clearly a modern and a secular writer, an authority on the novels of E.M. Forster and a student of modern such as Conrad. But as I continued to read McConkie, I began to understand more his affinity with the Bishop of Hippo. In his confessions, Augustine is relentless in his examination of his own faults and failings, his weaknesses and vanities, his talents and delusions. Augustine pays homage to his mother, Monica, for her faith and steadfastness. His mother's unwavering presence and affection lead him ultimately toward salvation and truth. Augustine is determined to witness to the reader the depth and paradoxes of his struggle and his victory. Quote, all this I do inside me in the huge court of memory, Augustine writes. There I have by me the sky, the earth, the sea, and all things in them which I have been able to perceive. There too I encounter myself. As I continued to read McConkie's stories in his books and in The New Yorker, I felt the uniqueness of his enterprise. He was on a mission to search for truth, for meaning in modern life. But ultimately, he was attempting to discover, if possible, what was still sacred in a world that seemed determined to be profane and to destroy itself. What made McConkie different from most contemporaries was not only his soul-searching honesty, his self-lacerating confessions of failures and weaknesses, but like Augustine, he was on a quest to find the spiritual, to know the sacred in a non-believing world. In former times, James McConkie would almost certainly have been a theological writer, probably a clergyman. But in a post-Darwin, post-Freudian, post-Holocaust world, he attempted to touch and communicate the divine in authentic experience of himself, other people, and the world around him. It is a quest whose grandeur is counterbalanced by the ordinariness of the details, the plainness and directness of his voice, the humility of his claims. But again and again, through his writing, McConkie finds the extraordinary in the ordinary. The casual detail or overheard comment becomes a revelation. McConkie is a poet without verse and a churchman without a creed. McConkie's stories are so memorable that when I go back to them some 30 years later, I'm astonished at how clearly I have remembered them. As a native of southern Appalachia, I was inspired by the accuracy and affection of his portraits of the people of eastern Kentucky, where he taught at Morehead State College before coming to Cornell. McConkie has a special affinity for working people, for the poor and disadvantaged. I will never forget his description of the poor boyhood friend in Arkansas who bites off his toenails in bed for fear of scratching the young Jim during a sleepover. Quote, "You scratched me. Your toenails are too long," I said. He quickly said, "I'm sorry," and sat up in bed, heard a nibbling sound. "What are you doing?" I said. But he held one foot in his mouth and then the other, nibbling and tearing at his nails. And then there's the wonderful account of living in a trailer in Iowa City while Jim was in graduate school, listening to a reading in the evening on the Philco radio of Francis Parkman's La Salle and the Discovery of the Great West. That was my introduction to Parkman's masterpiece. By my count, Jim has published 10 books and edited at least another 3. And there are far too many wonderful scenes in them for me to mention more than a fraction. Among my favorites is the account of the filling station attendant in Sicily who wants so badly to give the McConkie family a souvenir that he thrusts the rag with which he wipes windshields into Jim's hand. And then there is the account of the race across Germany in a jeep near the end of World War II to find a substance called fish lime for printing an army publication and being wounded when the vehicle hits a booby trap and wrecks. The German woman who attends the wounded McConkie is a never-to-be-forgotten instance of humanity and human connection in the least expected place. And only a writer of McConkie's integrity and candor would admit the connection he felt for the blue-eyed Nazi soldier who shouts, "Heil Hitler," and then waits to be shot by his captors. But in the short time I have here, I think the most effective way to celebrate the writing of James McConkie is to quote some short passages from the story that set his imagination off in its quest for art, for understanding, for the sacred, the story of the nightstand and the chain of events leading up to that significant memory. As the Madeleine was for Proust, opening the sluice gate of memory and artistry, so the little nightstand was for McConkie in 1960. Quote, "Wretched little nightstand acting as if its turn had come, as if it won't be satisfied until given its due." Quote, "I made it in the 9th grade. In the previous summer, despair had settled upon my family. Sudden poverty, for the Depression had reached us at last, was the cause. I shall say only that my parents were so distracted they moved here and there and finally to Arkansas, and that my father, a northern businessman, seriously considered pig raising as an occupation and ordered the proper leaflet from the government. An impossibility, of course, but so was everything else. In their chaos, my parents were separated. My father headed even further south, while my brother, my mother, and I sold all the furniture for gasoline and traveled halfway across the continent in the old Packard, symbol of former opulence, to knock without warning or invitation when midnight upon the door of the nearest relatives too tender to deny us admission. They took us in, that most kind uncle and aunt, not only us, the three of us, prickled and small with shame, but my dog as well, a thin and ravenous German shepherd, not unlike the one sleeping on the couch, as I recall the past on another midnight. For months thereafter, I was continually drowsy and my mind occupied with lassitudinous dreams. Full of humiliation and self-pity, I was pleased whenever someone spoke to me harshly for having neglected an assigned task. But let me pass over this year with my uncle and aunt simply by saying that my two semesters of ninth grade manual training produced only that one wobbly nightstand, its legs spindlier than any previous nightstand had been known to be. I'd plane them down, 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 day after day, with eyes shut. Once I opened them to see the instructor and the rest of the class standing in a half circle before my bench, laughing silently. The blueprint called for a drawer, which I had neither the time nor the aptitude to build, nor after the legs had been screwed to the top, did I even have time to paint or stain. I gave the nightstand to my mother for her birthday, my gift, a year's toil. She, do you believe it, cried. After this year with my relatives, my brother took a job in Michigan. We accompanied him. The dog, the nightstand, and my mother occupied the back of the car during the journey. Misfortune ensues once more, and once more as the result of insufficient cash. The finance company, the old opulence after all had been based on credit, took the Packard. A relative in Ohio, the dog, I cried when he was carted off in his railway express cage. Note how fully I am concerned with myself in these recollections. No mention of the perpetual grief and loneliness of my mother, no mention of my brother, 4 years my elder, who assumed the burdens of a father and who thus, instead of going to college, sold hamburgers at a dime store lunch counter, no mention of my still distracted father, who was traveling about the country, holding this job or that, sending us whatever money he could. My mother, always strongly religious, now went with unfailing regularity to church for spiritual counsel. As one less benighted, I refused to accompany her. I would make us rich by writing fiction. On Saturdays and Sundays, all weekend long, even after school, during the week, I would furiously write, sometimes one story a week, sometimes two, sometimes three, or even more. I would make us rich, yes, but even more than that, I was playing God, creating little dream worlds in which I could impose the pattern, in which I would bring love to hate, peace to violence, unity to chaos. The paper, the pencils, the typewriter ribbons took money from food, and the stories, 10-page thrillers, tales of suicide, rape, and murder, but all with happy endings, never sold. Even I knew they were poor. Such a succession of failures only made me increasingly belligerent when my mother continued to ask me to attend church services with her. And so we would quarrel. I was incensed by her mild, even meek determination to salvage my soul. Hiding behind the curtains of our second-story apartment, a small apartment in a frame dwelling on the fringes of the downtown area, I would watch as she stepped off the curb. Careful of that car, little mama, and walked quickly without a backward look toward the Presbyterian church 6 or 8 blocks away. But not until early morning, in those gray and heavy hours before sunrise, when a child awakening can sense death waiting for others, if not for himself. But I feel truly contrite. Alone and frightened, I would tiptoe into her room, then wake her gently. Mother, I'm sorry. Next Sunday I'll go. She would smile, clasp my hand, and fall back into sleep. The clock by her bed stood on the miserable nightstand I had made. This little idyll of my youth came to an end when we were no longer able to pay the modest rent for our apartment. My brother found other lodgings in town. Eventually, after visits with those second cousins who would have me, I returned to live with my uncle and aunt. My mother, how it anguished me at the time, took employment as a maid with still another relative, one insufferably rich and inexcusably distant in the bloodline. I need not comment on my intense loneliness, my bitterness. Indeed, they soon began to vanish, for my uncle and aunt gave me the love and care of parents. And then finally, the depression began to retreat, to disperse the way a shrouding cloud does before the moist winds of spring. Pockets slowly filled with cash again, madness departed the world, and my parents, as in my happy endings, were reunited. Yet I still recall a letter one written soon after she took her job as a maid. My room is cheerful, in a separate wing above the garage and with private bath. It is a home for me, though I look forward to the time our whole family can be together again. Photographs of you, your father, and your brother are on my bureau. The nightstand you made is, of course, by the bed. That wretched, miserable nightstand, wobbly, unpainted, without a drawer. I read the letter as many times as it was capable of imparting pain. I carried it in my pocket to my high school classes. It lay under my pillow at night. In my dreams, I saw my mother's face in sleep the moment before I had wakened her in my remorse. Had visions of tortured tables with twisted tops, with legs warped and wobbly as bent pins, and I tried to imagine her long bus trip from Michigan. Where had she put the nightstand? But the driver have argued that she couldn't take it, that it could travel with propriety neither in the luggage compartment nor in the racks. Later, I discovered that he had argued, and that she, in her mild perseverance, her gentle and maddening obstinacy, had won. It had occupied the seat next to her for the entire trip. A theme that runs through McConkie's work from beginning to end is the search for human connection, for brotherhood. On page 57 of Court of Memory, he writes, "Possibly brotherhood can be found in nobility of action and the virtuous cause, but I have discovered it, as these episodes suggest, chiefly in feelings of shared helplessness, impurity, and guilt. Caught in periods of depression by the sense not only of my own unsatisfactory nature, but of the equally unsatisfactory nature of the world, men about me, I thought brotherhood, that ostensible touching of wings, a circling flight from and back to the dark box of my ego. Angered with myself for crying brother whenever I meet up with my own flaws, I have on occasion thought, the blue-eyed puppet Nazi in your guts wants a comrade." Like James Agee, and now let us praise famous men, McConkie has a special affinity for the poor and struggling, but is untiring in his examination of himself, his motives and actions. He cuts himself little slack as he probes his own intentions, integrity, conscience, and memory. He is gentle with everybody but himself. Yet after years of vivid, dramatic, memorable reporting, meditations on his own life, he came to this recognition: "But I had not escaped fiction." As he realized that autobiography is also an imaginative construct, another kind of fiction, as all art includes selection, suppression, distortion for emphasis, shaping for clarity. As with the stories of his beloved Chekhov, there is something at once deeply satisfying and deeply unsettling about McConkie's narratives. He delights us with the clarity of his exposition, His sentences hone to lapidary brightness. There is an intense integrity, a clear-headed sense of responsibility to the language and to the reader. The stories have a poignance, poise, and gravitas. When I read his account of visiting Mammoth Cave with his fiancée at Christmas 1943 before shipping out for war, I wept. The vividness of his memory of the train station, the old hotel, the countryside, the tour of the cave, dread of the future and of leaving Gladys is so powerful it hurts. His account of almost consummating their marriage before the ceremony reveals the times and the people in both comic and breathtaking brevity. McConkie shares with the great Anton a concern with complexity, paradox, the surprise that suddenly shifts the paradigm. Like the Russian master, he's rarely judgmental, except with himself. There is a wholeness to McConkie's vision that echoes the breadth of Chekhov's world. On the evidence of the fictional stories printed in Nightstand, I regret that McConkie gave up writing short stories. But on the other hand, he's given us the richness and insights of the unforgettable nonfiction narratives. The world would be poor without Court of Memory and the other books. What is unsettling about McConkie's writing is, I think, the intensity of his quest for the spiritual colliding with the toughness of his honesty and skeptical self-revelation. It would be hard to think of another writer more sensitive to those around him, human and animals and environment. McConkie has a deep sense of responsibility to attend, to witness, to report, and testify. So much of his writing is what would have been called in the Baptist churches I attended when young, a testimonial. A testimonial could be either a confession of failure or of victory. On page 21 of Court of Memory, he describes sitting on a tin roof with Gladys at night watching a display of the northern lights. Quote, it was very still that night, and we heard the faint honking of geese long before we saw them. And so when we did see them, we were prepared for the pattern flight, for the high birds outlined against the pulsating streams of red and yellow and green. They entered the crown directly above us and passed into the dark, heading not due south but southeast, for they were following the waterways, and below our house beyond the park, Six Mile Creek, heavy with autumnal rains, was rushing southwestward and over Van Natus Dam. I'd not heard the sound of the water until the geese flew by, but then the roar was steady and strong. My wife held my hand. I don't think I've ever been so happy, she said. I'm happy enough to die. And so was I at that moment. I thought myself capable of soaring off that tin roof to impale myself without regret on my neighbor's white painted and most proper picket fence 10 feet below. Occupied with the thorniest existential and theological questions, McConkie imposes no answers. He gives us facts and poses questions. He relates and speculates, writing about Augustine and Bishop Spong and the challenges of belief in our times. He observes, quote, in the current neurobiological view, the mind is created by the brain. But unlike the brain, it is clearly not a substance, but a quality. The testimony, that is, the confessions, describes Augustine's long labor before his own reason made it clear to him that God is not a substance existing everywhere and at every moment in the observable universe of space and time. God then is mind. However circumscribed or otherwise limited it is, the human mind is an image of the divine mind containing more than it can know it knows. We're told that Chekhov's favorite story was The Student. Chekhov was a known agnostic, but his character here is a theology student who's been hunting on Good Friday. Suddenly the wind turns cold and depressing, and as he returns to the village, the student doubts himself and the purpose of his calling. Passing a widow and her daughters heating water over a fire in their yard, he comments to them that it was over just such a fire that Peter warmed his hands after denying Christ 3 times. The widow and her daughter are deeply affected by the mention of that story. And as he walks on, the student is struck by the power of narrative to reach like a chain across 1900 years and touch people that deeply. And as he nears the ferry, he feels a return of his confidence and a sense of purpose. It is stories that give meaning to our chaotic lives. A truly modern, as well as a classical writer, McConkie offers us no sure answers beyond the power of narrative and human connection and the miracle of being. Rather than preach, he is a witness to his own quest and failures, connection and recognitions. He's unsettling because he peels the layers of experience deeper and deeper. He's satisfying because he proves by example that the sacredness will always be in the journey, in the struggle, in the quest itself. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.